Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
All right, welcome to the Buzz on Technical Rescue. I'm Bob Duma, your host for today's program. We're recording today's program at Firehouse World in San Diego, California. Our panelists today join me to talk a little bit about West Coast Technical Rescue. I'd like to start out by introducing my guests. Today, let's start out with Todd Fetters. Could you give us a little bit of background on yourself for our listeners?
Sure. Hi, guys. Todd Fetters. My background with TechSearch is since 92 when we started the FEMA programs. I was on California Task Force 6. One of the 28 teams in the United States. I've been out the door quite a few times. I deployed to Northridge Earthquake, 9/11 on the first wave, went to Katrina, and was recently a FOB on the incident support team during Hurricane Irene.
Great, Todd. Thanks for joining us. And also on our panel today, Kent Freeman, individual who's joined us a few times in the past. Appreciate having you come back. Kent, might let our listeners know a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I recently retired with Roseville Fire Department, served as a captain there for 30 years. Last half of that career, we'd activated a local government USAR task force, so I was a captain on that USAR task force there, and then done a lot of work with California State Fire Training and curriculum development in the area of USAR, so developed the Confined Space Rescue Awareness Program, and then that was the project leader for the Confined Space Rescue Technician Program, and I'm currently on the work group that's wrapping up the Trench Rescue Technician Program.
Excellent. And you definitely want to start out by just thanking both of you for taking time out of your schedule here at Firehouse World for joining me. Let's kind of just get things going today. We'll talk a little bit about, just get your overview of where you see technical rescue and the emergency service family going in the future. It's had a lot of changes over the last few years, especially since the events of 9/11. So why don't we start out with you, Todd. Where do you kind of see our current status and maybe where we're going in the semi-near future?
Well, I see safety is going to stay, it's going to remain paramount with that. I believe some of the older technologies like thermal imaging, I am real excited about seeing the things that we're going to have access to now that we're moving our troops out of Iraq and it appears soon out of Afghanistan. We're going to have access to some of the really technical, well-established programs that they've been using for our military, things like FLIR, thermal imaging, the stuff that right now that we have, I believe, is not to say it's antiquated, but I do know for a fact that the military has developed some really extensive products out there that will become, you know, we will be able to get our hands on. Another place that kind of a double-edged sword gives me a little bit of concern is the use of UAVs. Recently, it was approved for use in the United States to have UAVs flying. There's obviously a terrorist potential to deliver some kind of an event, you know, on our nation through the use of an unmanned aerial vehicle. But also the ability to get real-time intelligence when you're trying to filter all the information coming in during some kind of an event, you know, of a technical rescue nature or a disaster, things like that, using the unmanned aerial vehicles or robotics platform. The robotics things are kicking off large, spending a lot of money. I don't believe they're there yet, but they're still trying. They're doing a lot with it. They got a long ways to go. They'll never replace human beings. It's still a labor-intensive situation, but like I say, those are probably two things that are driving what we're doing right now and looking at, and we can thank the military and what they've developed over the last period of time on our war of terror that are going to be available to us hopefully fairly soon.
And I think it's a good point with the unmanned aircraft, especially some of the wildland type of events specifically that are more known here on the West Coast. You're covering significantly large square mile areas of topography that a lot of times just is not accessible by truck or Jeep or any type of vehicle. So I think there's definitely a platform for it. And like many of the things, such as Incident Command, it kind of got its foundation here and spread around the rest of the country and evolved to what it is today. This may be another one of those kickoff points where it's put to the beta test and then over the next decade or two becomes pretty much common activity for the general fire service. And Kent, what is your thoughts on where we're at and where we're going?
Well, unfortunately, you look at a lot of the stuff's going to be dollar-driven. And so we're trying to, you know, we try to switch around with where the money is available. So a lot of this money is available in grants. So you look at a lot of what we've had to do, even in the USAR community, really trying to focus on how do I submit grants and just trying to get grant training to be able to try and come up with some of the equipment and the funding that we need. So I think funding will continue to be a problem for us, no doubt about it. I do have to agree with Todd on the new technology and some of this real simple new technology that's going to change the face of what we do. I mean, you just look at some of the new equipment out just in rope, the new CMC MPD product that really sort of changes around the way we've done some of our basic rope operations if you've got the funding to buy those. So once again, the dollar's going to drive some of that. I'm sure we're going to stick with some of those basic operations, but some of that new equipment is going to change the way we do business. And I think when you look at funding also, we're going to continue to really look at regional responses, how we can do that cost effectively without spending more money than we need to, just bring in a lot of equipment and a lot of people that really aren't functioning a purpose for us. So I think we need to look at how we right-size some of that also.
And I think that's a good point to hit on. We're all being squeeze per se in the economic side of life, and for the past 10 plus years we've been pretty much riding the crest of the wave of the post 9/11 era of funding was pretty lucrative. Many of the grant programs such as UWASI is now starting to shrink down or in some cases dry up depending on where you are in the hierarchy of priorities for that. So many of the communities grew at a level totally unexpected and at a pace where I think what we're looking at now, too, one of the biggest fears is the sustainment capacity of these current teams that are on the road. What will they be in another 5 years? Will we be buying other teams' equipment on pennies on the dollar because they basically had to shut down operations due to the lack of capability of sustaining? Having the equipment and having a team is one thing. Having one ready to roll and proficient is another. With that, out here on the West Coast, I know there's a lot of variables that, you know, we deal with on the East Coast as well, but you have a much larger population of FEMA teams within California itself, and also, as we were talking prior to the show, about your regional teams. Could you go, both of you, kind of just get into a little bit about how the regional teams function and, you know, how they're viewed and basically the chain of response at a major event?
Well, we're looking at what we're calling here is an RTF, a regional task force, and it's sort of evolved. I think the last meetings, and correct me if I'm stating something that's a little bit incorrect, Todd, also, but the last meetings that we just had on RTFs, I think we've upped those now, was originally started out as a 27-member team. The latest meetings that were just attended says we're going to go to a 30-member team. They're changing a little bit of the terminology on some of those positions, so we're not mandated and held to some of the FEMA criteria. So a few of those changes are actually taking place. But what you're really looking at is you're looking at a USAR response that is far more streamlined. It's not as big, so you're able to get out the door quicker. And I think that's really where the biggest advantage is. You're looking at a 30-member team with really one heavy complement of equipment that's able to get out of the door in probably closer to 20 to 25 minutes because it's rostered on each cycle, on each shift. And so they're out the door very quickly. They're able to respond in a very timely manner, and they're not nearly as expensive to do that. Now, the problem with that, though, is it's all funded by the local government. So really, they're coughing up all that money to try and keep that team rolling, to keep it available and to keep it going. And I think that's where the biggest problem was with a lot of those organizations that said, well, look, you're mandating FEMA standards on us that are really over the top costly, but yet we're funding this whole thing. So that's where we've come to a compromise with some programs that are some training requirements that are reasonable, that are a little bit more cost effective for us to meet. We get a team that's out of the door a lot quicker. And hopefully for some of those smaller events, we don't have to activate the whole team. Okay, that, you know, that large, very costly team that rolls out there that is more, maybe an overkill for some of the smaller events. So the RTF is sort of fits that bill. I think that we're starting to look a little bit more of a blending where both of those teams are agreeing upon, yeah, we do this, you do that, we do these things together, and then we're all going to see each other at this large event and how that's going to come together. There's still some wrinkles that need to be ironed out there. But the RTF, I think, is it's a really good process that we've sort of come together with here in California. To be honest with you, I don't know how many we've got all legitimately put together, but we've got a few of those that are already legitimately actually put together, both in the north and the south. And like I say, we're still working through some of the finer details, but there's some very well-trained individuals that are also on those other FEMA teams also.
So actually, we're getting a lot more return on our investment. Those individuals that have had the luxury of training to the FEMA level, the reality is there aren't that many deployments, even on the bad years, but now that knowledge isn't going stale. They're able to give it back to the local community. And prior to starting today's segment, Todd, you were talking about the term resource multiplier. You know, kind of let the listener know a little bit about what you were talking about there and how that's actually, I think, ties right into what Kent was just talking about.
Yeah, in reference to force multiplication, it's kind of a concept, and Ken's, he's hitting a home run exactly. The whole idea behind the regionals is they were going to get out the door. They're on duty at that time. They're assigned to their heavy unit. They've got guys that go out maybe on an OAS engine, which is now Calima in California. They're going to deploy into the field with a very robust capability. They're going to be able to be self-sufficient for the full 72 hours. They will come in. They will assist a local government agency with a large disaster or a small issue, whatever it is, they'll be able to provide a great service in that respect. And then as the needs of the incident grows, then a FEMA team, one of the eight in California, for an example, might be brought in to force multiply. There's some other different options with force multiplication. We've done some classes, search classes, if you will, for the California Highway Patrol. They've got what's called the Mobile Field Force, MFF in short. Those are primarily their riot suppression units, and they're throughout California. They bring those guys together, and their capabilities are obvious, law enforcement. However, with some search training, those guys would like to play as well. Not only are you bringing your force protection with you, you've got folks that are armed and can provide safety for the teams, but they also have the ability to act somewhat as a emergent volunteer, if you will, with a lot of capability to go out and provide some kind of assistance on a basic search in an area. I mean, when you're getting a little bit away from the specialized concept, you need some folks that can provide a basic physical void search or a wide open area search. That's an excellent resource. So basically, you got to get a robust resource in there quickly and have them operating within the system as in the SAR branch or whatever under the local government control. And then there's got to be an element of force protection and force multiplication that'll come in and assist. And that's, in my opinion, if we were looking at this correctly from our FEMA standpoint, because it does take us a little bit of time to get our heavy resources out the door and on site, that's a perfect model for California. I am a little bit disappointed. I haven't vetted this information. The state of Florida funds their regionals at a tune of roughly $30 million a year. I'm not certain how many the numbers are, and that is not money that is spent as well on the two FEMA task forces, Florida 1 and 2. So the state of Florida, and there's an obvious understanding, they've got a good need with the weather events that they suffer and things like that. But I would say that we're not funding appropriately in California, and like Kent was saying, I believe that is the weakness. There's an element of control. There was an element of groups that meet that make policy, if you will, and provide direction. The funding, however, I think is a little light, and it does put a lot of strain on organizations like Long Beach Fire and Ventura County and some of the other robust regionals that are out there. My understanding, and I've had this conversation with some of the folks that are running the programs at the state level through CalEMA, is that there's 11 regionals in California, but I think Kent hit it exactly right. I'm not certain they're up, running, and robust and ready to deploy as a regional yet, and it's all about funding.
I think that goes across the board. I know in New York we have Task Force 1, a FEMA team, which comes out of the New York City area, and then Task Force 2, which is a state-based response task force housed out of Albany, our capital area of New York, and then a number of the larger career departments have gone in and done extensive training in various areas. We'll focus on collapse rescue. What we're finding now is the initial concept was there there wasn't funding or a need to have additional task forces in the state, but use them as force multipliers with a IST type of component overheading and bringing them together or to assist in the longevity of a response from the state level. But what we're seeing in the individual departments, it goes back to the fiscal issues that are happening not only across the country but across the world. They got their initial training. Basically, the seed money has been spent, but that sustainment and getting them the hours out of service to retain and maintain those skills and to maintain the proficiency is slipping away, and it's across the whole state corridor, not just one individual department. So looking at the more similar to what you're doing with your regional response groups, having county base where you're drawing from these elements and that. So we're basically in a mode of retooling. Industry's had to do it, and we're always like 2 or 3 years behind what industry does in the fire service. They've retooled, remanufactured their way of doing business. I think we're just basically in the early stages of that ourselves.
If I could add, though, to what Todd, you know, what Todd mentioned, it's, I think it's a deficit that CalEMA, at the time that they activated this, was California OES. But when CalEMA said, we're going to do these RTFs, there was actually no funding mechanism for them at all. And they came to these organizations and said, look, we're going to activate this thing. And a lot of organizations jumped on that bandwagon, realizing it was going to be a great platform to be able to respond off of, and they'd be able to mobilize throughout the state to assist in these large events that we have in the USAR, you know, those USAR events. So they jumped on it, but there was absolutely no funding. And while that was a total disadvantage, I think you always have to look at the good side on some of the stuff. The good thing about it was some of these agencies could not do it on their own. And so what they did was they banded together. So you look at Area E in LA, you know, five organizations that came together and said, well, then let's do an RTF together. You look at Ventura, which actually went in with Santa Barbara County. So you had Santa Barbara County and Ventura County that came together and said, let's do an RTF. Now, here are agencies that previously may have, and in many cases did not, train together in the area of USAR, who then came together, mobilized this RTF together, and became active players together. Now, with the funding, if we can get some additional funding, some of those people may actually separate, but there's an advantage out of the fact that all those parties came together, and now we've got people playing together that all understand each other and work well together. So hopefully we can fix some of the funding, but there's been some advantage out of it also, I think. And I think it is a very good platform, and I think we're starting to see a little bit more agreement between those FEMA teams and the RTFs also. And there's a lot of agencies that are still looking at that platform going, maybe we should go here, you know?
And change is never easy.
No.
You always are going to have territorial issues, or it's like if you're a congressional representative, you don't mind if any base is closed around the country as long as it's not the base in your voting district. So, you know, you take care of your own, but I think we're living the reality of the world we're in right now with this. You know, kind of looking back in time slightly, the year 2011 was pretty horrific around the world for major tragedies and basically weather-related activities that put a heavy strain on technical rescue responses, urban search and rescue teams, both local, state, and federal levels, depending on where the events took place. I know some of our FEMA teams and our two internationally deployable teams were basically in and out the door, back-to-back responses at one period early last year. Kind of looking at that, how did that impact your visions? I know both of you are heavily involved with both training and development of different activities. When you use case histories to kind of steer yourselves individually, Ken, how did that impact what you're doing this year, or how did it help you prioritize your needs for your training side of life?
Well, you know, once again, I'm not actively responding on a FEMA team right now, so when you look at the actual response, it didn't specifically impact me as far as that, but whenever we see events that are occurring worldwide or locally or regionally throughout the country, you're always looking at that and going, okay, how do I respond to this, and what does this now bring to the forefront? And I think every one of these events does bring something new to either we're looking at, okay, well, we need to switch some technology, or we need to change around the way that we operate as far as administratively, or some of those technical applications. I think some of that stuff is still forthcoming. I think we're still going to continue to see things that came from some of those large-scale events that says, you know, we need to respond in a different way. When you look at the events in Japan, I mean, you're talking about an organization there, or you're talking about a country there that's already very technological, It's not like Haiti when we had an event there and we're going to roll in and we're it. I mean, you know, those people that came in are the ones that are going to bring the technology. Japan already had a lot of technology, and I think there's a lot to be learned from every one of those events. So I think a lot of that is still transitioning. As far as the way I operate, as far as the curriculum that we look at, a lot of what I'm doing is a little bit more finer detail when you look at confined space and trench, those types of applications. Probably didn't have a huge application on the curriculum that I'm working on, but you always look at every one of those events and go, okay, how do I respond to this? How do I move forward on those types of events when or if they occur in my geographical area?
You know, it's always a lessons learned.
Yes.
You know, and Todd, any of the things that you've run into or been exposed to has helped guide you into the next phase of your background?
It is interesting. FEMA's looking at a model of modularizing some of their search components, and it was based on a request that came out of the Joplin, Missouri tornadoes for what we reference as HRT, which is, we don't try to stay away from the cadaver term. However, for Live Find as well, they're trying to modularize it somewhat so that if there is a request specifically, we don't have to mobilize a large entire Type 1 task force to meet the needs of a community that needs our resources. It's interesting, and it was driven primarily by Hurricane Katrina, that we are no longer a USAR organization. None of us are. We are now a SAR organization, and the main difference is we are expected to be proficient on all types of events, whether it's on the water, which primarily it was what happened down at Hurricane Katrina in the Louisiana area, and also, you know, in the different weather events and things of that nature. We have different partners now. The Coast Guard's heavily involved, the military, we have the National Park Service, we have other agencies. We have to be proficient in a wide area search environment. We have to be able to provide all these different kind of services, so we're really starting to look at the training that we have to provide and get our people exposed to. Another thing we're seeing is technology. Technology is so far out ahead of everybody that it's just interesting. In my opinion, there's some things that are going to happen in society. Is handheld GPSs, I think, are going to be a thing of the past. I think that fairly inexpensive cameras are also going to be a thing of the past, because one smartphone can provide you so many different capabilities. Not only that, you can give real-time feedback to somebody in a command post through an email system from your smartphone that'll give the exact coordinate and fairly accurately as exactly where you're at. So there's things that are driving all kinds of issues. Other communities, you know, the EMAC, the neighbor helping neighbor concept and things like that, that seemed a little more attractive than FEMA. So from my standpoint, we've got a ways to go to make certain that we provide the modularity, that we don't have to roll up with the 70-plus member team and say, hey, here we are, this is how we roll, you know, because not necessarily that's not going to be the answer. The worst thing, in my opinion, that anybody can do that comes to help another jurisdiction is to roll up and go, hey, we're here, when's chow time? And where do we sleep and where do we park our vehicles? We need to come there. We need to fit in with their command structure. We don't need to take over. We need to be able to just say, here's what we can provide for you. You let us know what we want and we will do it. And I'm very proud as a member of Task Force 6. That's what we were able to do at 9/11. They were very clear that they did not need a large rescue component. They only needed search. And we were able to cooperate, and we were utilized quite a bit. We used a lot of our resources. Our engineers, once we showed up, our structural engineers, we never saw them again for the rest of the deployment until we shipped back to this coast. So those are things we have to remain somewhat flexible and remember that, you know, as far as our large organization, that we have to be able to provide the component that they want or need.
And I think that breaking down of the elements, and I think whether we're consciously or subconsciously doing it, we look at our presidential directives that come down, and they want the government to be run and cared for at its lowest common denominator, which is the local entity government, or in our case, response capability. So many of our listeners or many of our emergency service comrades really don't understand it. If something bad happens in your community, the FEMA team just isn't automatically on its way. There's many steps in the process that have to take place. First would be getting that regional response team there, and then each one has its own significance of timelines of activity and how long they're going to be able to cover the operation. So I think, you know, we're retooling once again into that mode and, you know, getting the best bang for our dollar, basically. But by bringing, in your cases, you know, these previously trained at the FEMA level responders into the local community, you know, that's a resource you can't just go out and buy off the shelf. You know, the life experience or just the level of training that the team members possess that's now being given to another level below the FEMA level, it's really, we're getting a good return on our investment. And with that said, I know we'll be doing a show in the future with Todd and I about the search team component of a FEMA team, and we'll talk a little bit more when we get to that show. And, you know, you can listen to it on further events that we have coming up this year on the Buzz at firehouse.com. With that, as we move forward, each coast in the central United States areas have similarities but do things a little bit different. Out here, Cal OSHA is your governing body. We were talking a little bit about confined space and the different emphasis that are being put on it in the California region by Cal OSHA. And Ken, you want to kind of take this question and kind of give us a little background about some recent developments that are happening here that could be very easily transferred to other parts of the country that have OSHA-based safety regulations.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of similarities on one of the other applications, too, that I'll get to here. But first of all, just here in California, Cal OSHA has placed a new enforcement emphasis on the area confined space. They look back after last year in 2011, which we saw 2010 was sort of a banner year for bonehead moves in confined space for even us in the fire service. We made some pretty big moves that were very bad. I mean, the International Association of Fire Chiefs even came out and did a national stand-down day on confined space because we made mistakes. OSHA, looking at complete occupational, went back, looked at 2010 and said, you know, we had some pretty big accidents that occurred in confined space with multiple fatalities. We had the Baxter Lab event in the covered by LA City, but in the Glendale area there in Atwater Village. That was an event that occurred. We had another event at a dairy where a couple of brothers died, one going in after another. There was a handful of these. OSHA looked at those and said, it can't happen. So doing a special enforcement effort in the area of confined space. So no matter what business they go into, they're asking these businesses, do you do confined space entry? If you do, we want to see your complete program, we want to see your permit program, we want to see your IIPP, and we want to see your rescue plan. Now that's placed most all these organizations because they've been aware of that. These companies have been advised by Cal OSHA Reporter, which is a third party that advises on this stuff, and quite a few other safety agencies that, hey, they're coming, they're going to be looking at this. So those companies now are going, okay, how do we do this? Do we put our program together? And they're looking at the local fire departments also and going, hey, look, can you help us with this? If we develop a tiered rescue plan, can we do these low-risk options while we're waiting for you to arrive? And so we're seeing an emphasis on the local fire departments where there's an expectation, hey, can you do this for us? And if you can't, why not? Because we pay tax dollars. And so they're going to want answers to these things. So that means we've got to be on our game. They're going to want written programs. Now, likewise, we've seen at the ANSI level, ANSI has, way back in 2007, they developed ANSI 359. Actually, I take that back. It was actually before that. But in 2007, we saw a lot of updates in the ANSI 359 document, which is on fall protection. We've seen some recent updates now in that, and they've really focused on rescue. So in other words, the fall protection programs that we have out there at the state are driven by NIOSH, ANSI, NFPA in some cases. In fall protection, we got very big on making sure that there was a system that would catch this person when they fell, but after that, there was a lack of emphasis. So in other words, the system worked. Now my employee was left hanging there. Now ANSI has come back in, as well as OSHA, and here in California, a big focus, saying, okay, so your system worked. Now he's hanging there, but now he's going to die from suspension trauma or orthostatic intolerance. What's the rest of the program? And so they're really enforcing that. So you're finding local fire departments finding pressure now as these companies are coming to them and saying, how can you help me when my employee now is hanging in a harness. I can do these things. What can you do after that? And if you look at ANSI 359, I can't quote for you the exact section, but in 359 it says if you're going to use a professional agency, which could be the fire department, they must tell you what their strategies are and their written programs and plans for effecting that rescue. So we're going to see fire departments looking at some scrutiny there where those agencies are going to go, look, we pay the freight for you to exist. What are you doing for me? And so we'll have to step up also in those areas also. Those are all, some of these are consensus standards. Some of them are regulations that are mandated on these organizations and these companies. They're going to be looking to us for help. And so we need to be ahead of that curve. I think we need to already be ahead saying, look, these are the things we can do for you. You do need to realize these are special operations. Not every engine company can handle these tasks, and we've got them scattered through our jurisdiction. So you've got to be able to do some things for your employee while we're rolling in with this equipment. Also helpful is if you advise them to be very specific about their needs so that we roll the right equipment in. Not an industrial accident, but a confined space accident is going to get a different response, so we want to advise them of those things too. But some of this is regulatory. I think we're going to see even more emphasis on it by a lot of the local OSHAs.
I think it kind of plays on a couple different lines of thought. We're pretty much running parallel to something that was mentioned earlier in our conversation. We've gotten to a certain level of competency, but we haven't maintained it. And now we're being taken to task to, you know, prove what we say we can do, and it's coming from those that are providing the funders, the taxpayers, mm-hmm. and those that are being governed by, in the California case, you know, Cal OSHA and the various organizations that you utilize out here. And it's the same as you travel around the country. They're just called something different or come under a different shingle as they enter your plant. With that, a little bit was mentioned, too, about new technologies in the area of rope rescue. We've kind of gone full circle. Back in early years of rope work, we used a lot of mechanical devices, and then we steered away from that and got into a lot of hardware, software style designs, and now the inception or the acceptance of a lot of new technology, such as the MPD and tools of that sort, I think are going to be a real positive change in the fire services mechanism as far as rope rescue. I know in New York, I work with our curriculum development team. We've been working a number of years doing a rewrite on our technician level courses, and when we start looking at how to do things and maintain these skills, these tools are giving us the ability to kind of hold that skill a little bit longer because the learning curve on them is the same as with the other tools, but the retention seems to be much better. There aren't as many deviations, and you know, as Todd hit on, we're at the benefit of many of the advancements that have happened elsewhere, the military and so on, for this. Any types of technology advancements other than what we already talked about that you guys are experiencing either in the search and rescue field or in the various fields you hit on, Kent, for as far as that goes? We'll start with, how about Todd, anything that you've experienced now with new technology that's actually in your hands and not a futuristic tool?
You know, one of the things that they've looked at, there's still a lot. Like I said, I hit on the robotics a little bit, and there is the aerial platform robotics. They've got some really neat helicopters that can give us a look at an incident from very far away without entering an area and doing what we call a recon, which is just a quick down and dirty look at what's going on so that we can put our scarce resources in the appropriate locations. Thermal imaging, again, we're starting to look at it. It's not, you know, a huge new technological advance. However, it is something we need to start considering to use. There are some other ground-penetrating radar is something we're looking at as well. The robotics still haven't caught up in other terms. We did recently do a training session where we had a robotic snake, if you will, deployed with a camera off of a search dog. Basically, it's programmed when the dog goes into a bark alert, so you can set it inside of a, what we would term as a collapsed structure, confined space, what have you, well out of sight of the handler or the manager, and as soon as it gives a bark alert, that will deploy off of the pack a camera in the form of a robotic snake that can mobilize itself somewhere within that area and give you a picture of what's going on with a live find victim. In that respect, there's a lot of things coming down the pike like that. Cameras are getting smaller. There's multiple companies that are giving us cameras that will increase our reach into a structure where a human being can't necessarily penetrate. The listening devices, there's some development going on right now to make them wireless because there's a certain amount of difficulty in managing the cord systems with them and things of that nature. There's pretty huge disconnects with that to this point. I don't know how successful they're going to be. Obviously, on a lot of collapsed structures and sites like that, there's an interference. So there's still some work being done there. And it'll be interesting to see how those pan out. But by and large, I think that we're seeing camera systems are better resolution. They're more designed for SAR rather than just the fire behavior event and things of that nature. So you're seeing cameras that have zoom features. You're seeing them that have, you know, high resolution. They have an excellent color picture so we can make out shapes. Those are the things that I'm seeing is that they're really coming into the technology that we saw, especially like Cannon mentioned about Japan. That's a highly advanced technological society, and we are enjoying some of the successes of those things through our own products that are coming down. Nothing really earth-shattering yet. Like I say, with the robotics, they've still got a ways to go. It's actually pretty funny watching some of the demonstrations because they're pretty frustrated with some of the stuff. Underwater things are pretty well. The aerial platforms are well, but as far as trying to get something into a building, you know, to search, it's still better done by human beings. Boots on the ground.
You know, it's kind of good. You used the term a moment ago, aren't earth-shattering, but I think sometimes, too, we become so immersed in the worlds we come from, in this case, the urban search and rescue worlds. You know, we see these changes, but then when I talk to folks from outside of the response community and they see how we're evolving, we're actually in the middle, I think, of a really good transition. And in a very short period of time, you hit on some excellent changes that are coming down the road. And you've got a number of years in the system. If you think back to where it was the day you arrived as the new guy on the team as compared to where it is today, and I think things grow exponentially in a very rapid manner. I know when Kim Allen does some of her presentations here at our show, she talks about the growth of things in life and how, you know, the days that you buy one item, we used to say when you take your car off the showroom floor, how much it depreciates, and the same things happen in technology. Ken, anything's popping in your head that fit in the same general?
Yeah, you go back to some real basic stuff, and I think one of the problems we have is, well, I don't say a problem. We in the fire service, a lot of times, we look at what we do and we go, boy, this is it. This is what we do, and we seem to think we're developing this equipment and that we've come up with these ideas. But 9 times out of 10, you look back and you go, geez, we just took something from some other industry and made an application for ourselves out of that, or we robbed some idea from some other industry and said, this is great, it's going to work for us. So you take that back to fall rescue or to confined space, and there's some stuff out there, I won't call it new technology, just we're taking some equipment that other people, cable riggers or other rope access technicians have been using and going, you know what, this has a pretty good application for us, and for $90, I don't have to enter the space, I can get the guy out without going in after him. So I'll give you the example. You go to a rope grab, the MIO industrial rope grab. We've been pushing this thing for years. Many companies make a rope grab. They use it for people that are working on platforms or in different rope areas where if they fall, this is going to grab the rope and keep them from falling. We take that same piece of equipment, we turn it upside down and let it ride down the rope to the victim that's inside the space who's on a retrieval line, and now I can haul them without going in after them. So for $90, I'm not entering the space. Now, that works great when they're on rope, but unfortunately, most of our people in industry are hanging on cable. And we really didn't have a good application to transfer to that cable problem, so that meant now we were going in after the guy. Well, you just have to look around, and you go to the cable riggers, and they use what they call a pork chop. It's made by Klein Tools. It's called a Havens grip. Their size, they make an 1/8 inch to a 1/2 inch cable grip, or Havens grip, and that device works just like the rope grab. So now when you're hanging on that fall arrestor or hanging on that cable in that space on a failed cable winch, now I can slide this down your cable and I can bring you out without going in after you. Go back to what Todd was talking about, safety. If safety really is that emphasis, we ought to be looking at getting these people out of the space without going in after them. And now for $90, I'm not going in after the guy. I don't subject my people to the risk. It's equipment that's been there. We're just finding a different industry that was maybe using it for something different, and we're going, you know, that has a great application for us. We need to be open to that and looking at those options. So I think there are tools that are out there. We just need to keep our eyes open and make sure we're looking at things to make sure that they serve our purposes for us and keep an open mind, no doubt about it.
Definitely. And it's one of those things, it's constantly evolving, with the volume of activity that's going on and all the different subgroups within the technical rescue field. You look at a show like this, the vendors come out, there's new equipment on the floor every year or an old piece of equipment that's made a little bit better by the input from the end user and the technology folks and the individual companies. As we begin to wrap things up today, first I want to start by thanking you both again for joining us. This is the type of program we could go on indefinitely. There's a depth of knowledge, the passion you both bring to the table, helps to make shows like this enjoyable for both myself and our listeners. The big advantage our listeners have is, as I stated earlier, Todd and I will be recording a show in the near future revolving around urban search and rescue component. And from his background in that field, we'll get some good insight. And then Kent and I also will be getting together in the future doing a program on tower rescue. So look forward to some oncoming and upcoming shows with both of these individuals joining me. As we get ready to close up, just kind of ask each for a couple of closing thoughts. Todd, let's start with you on our wrap-up. Just anything that you didn't get to hit on today, and we'll move through to conclusion.
You know, one of the interesting things that's coming down the pike, so to speak, is there is an increase in our funding, and it's several hundred thousands of dollars for each of the 28 task forces. Now, with that said, it hasn't actually been committed because we are funded by grants every year. At any one given year, they can completely kibosh the entire FEMA SAR component. So we were really surprised that we were hoping just to maintain our amount of grant funding, but we're actually a couple hundred thousand dollars, and I've heard the term three or six, and I'm not sure which one's accurate, so I'll just stay away from that. Or, and this decision may have already been made or it's coming down to be made soon, they may stand up a 29th team because of, like you were saying, the extreme weather behavior and things that happened last year, unprecedented natural disasters, and it seems like those are things that we can look forward to in the future as well. May stand up another team in what they term, they being FEMA, an underrepresented area. And it's been strongly suggested that the state of Louisiana might be one of them. And these are just things that, we hear in the program at a high level and don't, that we can pass that on. But we'll see what happens. Now, whether we need an additional team, it's hard to say. We do need commitment for funding. That is the hardest thing. And of course, in California, it's critical. And I guess, basically, 94 was the last really major earthquake we had in Northridge in our state. Easter Sunday, I believe we got a mulligan because it happened out in the Mexican desert. If it happened in the San Diego area or somewhere in the L.A. Basin, there's computer modeling out there for those of you that like that, where there will be 1,600 simultaneous fires that start right at the initiation of an earthquake that was the strength of the one on last Easter Sunday. You think about the SAR component, which is heavily driven by the fire service, and think about the lack of capability. We are going to need resources from other states to come in and assist us just to start a basic SAR operation before our people can we can get the fires under control and then start operating. And we saw it in Northridge. So, but we're that much closer to the next event. It'll be interesting to see with what we have coming down and to see how our system, responds to it. So.
Great. Kent, any thoughts?
Well, first of all, I'd definitely like to thank you for having me here. I would definitely, I have to reinforce what Todd said. Hey, every day that goes by, we're that much closer to the next event. We definitely have to keep safety as a forefront there, that we're always want to be focusing on that. I would definitely be encouraging people to always keep an open mind. Think outside the box. There's a lot of different ways for us to operate out there. I think we need to be open to new technology. We need to be open to looking at maybe older equipment that we use in a new way. So we need to keep an open mind there. And definitely, it comes from a lot of the different occupational regulations out there, and enforcement arms also, all about planning. And I think that we've been pretty good about planning ahead, but I think we definitely need to continue to always be on that, on the forefront of that, planning ahead, thinking of the next thing, planning ahead on trying to provide safety for our people. You look at that whole plan, it's important. We have to have already thought through this stuff. Luck is definitely not a strategy, and hope isn't a tactic, so I want to make sure I'm on my game a little bit better than that. But definitely thanks for having me here.
You're totally welcome. It's nice having both of you join me. Look forward to future shows together. I'm Bob Dillon, the host for the Buzz on Technical Rescue. Hope you enjoyed our show today. If you have any other questions or input for future shows, or would like some feedback on some of the activities we talked about today and require more addition, I can be reached at bobdumel@firehouse.com. Thanks again for listening. Take care and be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.